We were advised to try to sleep, and despite the hour it was the middle of the afternoon, we almost all fell into leaden unconsciousness. We were wakened by a sergeant, who led us to the canteen. There I found Hals, Lenson, and Olnsheim. We talked about everything, particularly about the fall of Stalingrad. Hals maintained that it wasn't possible, the Sixth Army. My God. They couldn't be beaten by the Soviets. But since the communique tilde copyright said they were surrounded, that they didn't have anything more to fight with, what else could they do? They were forced to surrender. Well, then we'll have to try and rescue them, someone else said. It's too late, remarked one of the older men. It's all over. Shit, shit, shit. Hals clenched his fists. I just can't believe it. If for some the fall of Stalingrad was a staggering blow, for others it provoked a spirit of revenge which rekindled faltering spirits. In our group, given the wide range of ages, opinion was divided. The older men were, generally speaking, defeatist, while the younger ones were determined to liberate their comrades. We were walking back to our dormitory when a fight broke out for which I was mainly responsible. The fellow with the broken knee, my companion in that damned Renault, had just fallen into step with me. Well, you must be pleased, he said. It sounds as if we'll be going back tomorrow. I could see a certain irony on his face, and felt myself turning red with anger. That's enough from you, I shouted. I hope you're satisfied. We're going back, and it's at least partly your fault if my uncle is dead in Stalingrad. He turned pale. Who told you he's dead? If he's not dead, that's even worse, I went on shouting. You're nothing but a coward. It's you who told me we ought to leave them to their fate. My companion was astonished, and looked around for reactions. Then he grabbed my collar. Shut up. He ordered, lifting his fist. I kicked him in the shin. He was going to hit me when Hals grabbed his arm. That's enough, he said calmly. Stop it, or you'll get yourselves thrown in jail. So, you're another young fellow who wants what's coming to him? My antagonist was now carried away with rage. I'm going to give it to all of you, you. Drop it, Hals insisted. Shit. He didn't say anything more. A blow from Hal's fist caught him on the chin. He spun round and fell onto his backside in the snow. By now Lenson had come up too. You bunch of kid shits, shouted my driver. He tried to get up to return to the attack. Lenson, short and thick-set, kicked him in the face with his metal boot before he'd regained his balance. He fell onto his knees with a cry of pain, lifting his hands to his bloody face. Savage, somebody shouted. We didn't persist further, and rejoined the group, swearing under our breath. The others looked at us blackly, and two of them helped my driver to his feet. He was still groaning. We'll have to look out for that one, Hals warned. He might very well shoot one of us in the back the next time we're attacked. Reveille the next day was later than usual. We went out for company roll call and were greeted by a whirlwind of snow. With our heads muffled in our upturned collars to escape the stinging ice fragments in the wind, we heard some good news. Feldglaus, whom we hadn't seen in an eternity, was standing in front of us holding a piece of paper with both hands. He too was having trouble with the wind. Soldiers, he read, in the lull between two gusts. The High Command, aware of your condition, grants you a leave of 24 hours. Nevertheless, given the present situation, a counter-order could come at any time. You will, therefore, present yourselves at your billets every 2 hours. Needless to say, this will not give you time to call on lady friends or visit your families, he added, laughing. But at least you'll be able to write to them. Laus sent two men to fetch the mail, which was then distributed. There were four letters and a package for me. We would have liked to look at Kharkiv, but the appalling weather kept us indoors. We spent a restful day, preparing for the return journey. We were therefore astonished to be told next day that we would resupply with food and weapons a unit stationed in the combat zone. We were even given more or less precisely the location of our new destination. We were to proceed to a sector somewhere to the south of Voronezh. We received this news without enthusiasm.
Bah!
Said Hals. Whether we tramp through the snow to Kiev or to Voronezh, it's all the same thing.
Yes, said Olmsheim somewhat cautiously. But Voronezh is at the front.
I know, said Hals. But we'll have to see it sometime. As for me, I didn't know what to think. What really happened on a battlefield? I felt torn by curiosity and fear. The front, south of Voronezh, the Don, winter seemed endless. It snowed every day, almost without a break. At the end of February or beginning of March, one no longer remember which, we were taken by rail to a town used as a major supply center, some 50 miles from Kharkov. Food, blankets, medicines, and other supplies were stored in big sheds, and every cellar and hole in the ground was jammed with munitions. There were also repair shops, some indoors, others in the open air. Soldiers perching on tanks blew on their fingers when they grew too numb to hold a wrench. A system of trenches and strong points had been organized on the outskirts of the town. This part of the country suffered from frequent partisan attacks, often by large groups of men. Whenever this happened, every mechanic and warehouseman abandoned his tools and inventories for a machine gun, to protect the supplies and himself. The only advantage we have here, one of the soldiers said to me, is that we're very well fed. There's an awful lot of work. We have to organize our own defense. We take turns standing guard, and things can get pretty tough with the partisans. They've given us some hard times, even with all of us fighting, and they've already destroyed a lot. Several times the CO has asked for an infantry unit to help him out, but it's only happened once. An SS company came, but 3 days later they were sent on to the 6th Army. We've already had 40 killed, which is a lot for one company. That afternoon, we organized an odd-looking convoy using four-wheeled Russian carts to which runners could be attached, transforming them into sleighs. There were also some real sleighs, a few IDKAs, and even two or three troikas covered with decorations, all requisitioned from Russian civilians. As we started off, I remember wondering where we were taking this convoy, which looked so like Christmas, but whose load of shells and grenades was of such a different character. We set off towards the northwest, and a sector somewhere near Voronezh. We had been given special rations for the cold, new first aid kits, and a 2-day supply of pre-cooked dinners. We took a track more or less blocked with snow, which crossed the line of defenses that cut off the steppe. A bulky, hooded soldier, who was the only sentry in sight, waved to us as we slowly went by him. His round shape looked enormously vulnerable as he stood there, puffing on a huge covered pipe, with his feet planted in the snow. After an hour or so on the trail, which grew increasingly snowy, we fastened the runners to the wheels. Our leather boots, although they were remarkably waterproof, were not the ideal footgear for tramping through nearly 2 feet of snow. We tired quickly, and hung on to the horses' harnesses or the edges of the sleighs with the desperation of cripples clinging to their canes. I myself twisted my fingers into the long hair of one of those shaggy ponies whose pelts are thick and tufted, like sheep's wool. However, the horse's pace was too quick, and forced us into an exhausting rhythm which made us pour with sweat despite the cold. From time to time, one of the leaders of a column would stop and watch the long convoy going by, catching his breath under the pretext of checking the line of march. When they rejoined the column, it was always at the end of the line. I never saw anyone run back to the front. Hals, who had become a real friend, was holding on to the other side of my horse. Although he was much bigger and stronger than I, he also looked as though he were nearly through. His face was almost hidden between his upturned collar and his cap, which had been pulled down as far as it could go. His red nose, like everyone else's, was producing a plume of white vapor. We hardly spoke. I had learned to be as silent as Germans usually are, but, even without words, I knew that Hals was a friend who felt as warmly toward me as I did toward him. We gave each other occasional smiles of encouragement, as if to say, hang on. We'll make it. We halted at dusk,
Feeling that I had been pushed beyond the limits of my strength, I collapsed onto a cart shaft. My legs ached with stiffness, and I could feel exhaustion pulling down my face. Hals let himself fall onto the snow. Hey, my poor feet. All along the convoy, men were sitting or lying on the snow. We're not spending the night here, are we? Asked a young soldier who was sitting next to me. We looked at each other uneasily. I don't give a damn what anyone else does, said Hals, opening his mess tin. I'm not taking another step. You say that because you're still sweating. Wait until you're a little colder. Then you'll have to move if you don't want to freeze. Shit, said Hals without looking up. This food stinks. I opened my mess tin too. The cooked dinners they had given us early in the afternoon had long since cooled, and then frozen in the metal containers. It looked like tripe. All around us, other soldiers were making the same discovery. God damn it, said Hals. But there's no point in just throwing it out. What do you think? Someone asked Afeld, who was looking at the stuff in his own tin. Those bastards must have given us rotten meat. Or a week of leftovers. It's unbelievable. There's enough food in that town for a whole division. It's not edible. It stinks. We'll have to get out some cans. No you won't, the Feldwall flared out at us. We still have a long way to go, and none too much food as it is. Throw away the meat if you don't like it, and eat the cereal. Hals, who was never too particular, crunched something vaguely like a lamb cutlet between his teeth. 2 seconds later, he spat it out on the snow. Pah. It's rotten. The shits must have cooked a Bolshevik. In spite of our dismal situation, we couldn't help laughing. Faced with the ruins of the meal he had been anticipating with such eagerness, Hals was on the brink of one of his rare fits of rage. Given his giant size, these were always impressive. With a stream of oaths, he gave his mess tin a magisterial kick, which sent it flying across the snow. There was a silence, and then a few laughs. You've made things a lot better for yourself, said the young soldier standing beside me. Hals spun round, but said nothing. Then he slowly went off to pick up his tin. I began to wolf down the mess which had been flavored by the rotten meat. Hals, who looked crushed, collected his battered tin, whose contents had been scattered across the snow. A few minutes later, cursing a cruel fate, we were both digging into my ration. The non-coms appointed guards, and we were faced with the problem of where to sleep. Already clenched with cold, we wondered where and how to spread out our ground sheets. Some men dug themselves hollows in the snow, others constructed rough huts, using the sacks of dried grass which hung from each side of their horses' collars. Others tried to ensure a supply of warmth by making the horses lie down. We had already spent several nights out of doors, but always under more or less sheltered conditions. The fact of sleeping absolutely in the open in such appalling cold terrified us. Here and there, clusters of men discussed what we might do. Some thought we should keep on walking until we came to a village, or at least to some sort of building, on the grounds that it was better to die of exhaustion than of cold. According to this faction, if we stayed where we were, at least half of us would be dead by morning. We won't be coming to any village for at least 3 days, the non-coms told us. We'll have to make out the best we can. If only we could light a fire, one man exclaimed. His teeth were chattering, and his voice was almost a whimper. Appalled by the prospect, we prepared ourselves for the night as best we could. Hals and I reorganized the load on the sleigh so that there was a space between the cases of explosives big enough to hold us both. Despite the obvious danger of such a resting place, we preferred disintegration in a hot flash to death by freezing. Hals had the spirit to crack a few obscene jokes, and they made me laugh in spite of my misery. We managed to doze intermittently, huddled together, haunted by the fear of freezing in our sleep. We spent a fortnight in these bitter conditions, and it proved fatal for many of our group. On the third day we had 2 cases of pneumonia. On subsequent days we had frozen limbs and Herzogenaurach, a kind of gangrene from cold, which first attacks the exposed portion of the face, and then other parts of the body, even if they are covered. Those affected by this condition had to apply a thick yellow pomade, which made them look both comic and pitiable. Two soldiers, driven mad by despair, left the convoy one night, and lost themselves in the featureless immensity of snow. Another very young soldier called for his mother, and cried for hours. We tried alternately comforting and cursing him for disturbing our rest. Toward morning, after he had been quiet for a while, a shot jolted us all awake. We found him a short way off, where he had tried to put an end to his nightmare. But he had bungled his efforts and didn't die until the afternoon. My feet, tortured by so much walking and by the cold, caused me agonizing pain at first, but soon became so numb that I felt almost nothing. Later, when a doctor checked us, I saw that three of my toes had turned an ashen gray. Their nails remained stuck to the double pair of pestilential socks which I took off for the examination. A painful injection saved my toes from amputation. It still seems astonishing to me that any of us should have survived such an ordeal, especially I, who have never been particularly strong. Now, at last, I was going to experience war at the front and ordeals far worse than anything I had yet known. We used the huts and bunkers of a temporary Luftwaffen airfield for a rest that was indispensable. Most of the field had been abandoned by the Luftwaffe, which had been forced to withdraw farther to the west. Some fighter planes were still there, in various states of disrepair and covered with ice, but a rump ground staff had moved out most of the equipment on big sleighs pulled by tractors. We were allowed several days to restore ourselves in these more or less comfortable circumstances. However, the moment we began to look better, the authorities plunged us back into the thick of things. For the fighting troops of that sector, our company represented a considerable and unexpected supply of manpower. We were divided into fatigued parties and assigned various jobs. Three quarters of our men were put to work preparing positions for 77s and even for light machine guns. This meant shoveling masses of snow, and then attacking the earth, which was as hard as rock, with picks and explosives. Hals, Lenson, and I had managed to stay together. We were in a group that was ordered to supply an infantry section about 10 miles away with food and ammunition. We were given two sleighs, each with a troika of shaggy steppe ponies. The distance was not great, our equipment was better than we'd had on our last tragic expedition, and thinking that we could easily manage the round trip in a day, we accepted the job as an easy one. There were 8 of us altogether, counting the sergeant. I was on the second sleigh, which was carrying grenades and magazines for Spandau's machine gun from the Spandau works. Sitting on the back of the sleigh, I had plenty of time to observe the dreary, empty landscape. At rare intervals, small stands of spindly trees thrust up from the immaculate white ground. They seemed to be engaged in an unequal struggle with the overpowering whiteness. It seemed to be gaining on them, slowly but surely. There was nothing else to be seen in this countryside, which must surely be inhabited by wolves, nothing except for the opaque, grayish-yellow sky. We seemed to have reached the far end of the world. After a short time, we were following a depression in the snow which we took as an indication of a path. As we came to the edge of a thick forest, a soldier jumped up from behind a pile of wood, and stood in front of our first sleigh, which came to a dead stop. After a few words with our sergeant, he stepped aside, and we entered the forest, where we saw a Spandau in action, manned by 2 soldiers, and further on an ant-like swarm of soldiers and innumerable grey tents. There were a great many big guns, light tanks of the Alpenberg type, packs, anti-tank guns, and mortars set up on sleighs. A slaughtered horse had been pulled up into a tree, and was gradually being transformed into stakes by soldiers whose coats were spattered with blood. We were besieged by soldiers who asked us for mail, and cursed us when we said we didn't have any. An officer checked our orders. The company we were to resupply was farther to the east. He sent an orderly to guide us. We continued through the woods, which concealed some 3 or 4 thousand men, and then crossed a series of small, partly cleared hills, I can still see them with absolute clarity. The white snow was crossed by three telephone lines which had been more or less covered over. "Here we are," said the orderly, who was on horseback. "Beyond this crest you will be under enemy fire, so go as quickly as you can. Follow the telephone line. The company you're looking for is about a mile and a quarter from here." He saluted in the prescribed fashion and went off at a trot. We looked at each other. "Well, here I go again," said our sergeant, who undoubtedly was a long-time Rollbane veteran. He waved us forward, then stopped us. "We're going to try and get there really fast. Don't be afraid to beat the horses. If the Russians see us, they'll open fire, but it usually takes them a while. If things get too hot we'll leave the sleigh with ammunition, because if that goes anyone closer than 30 yards we'll never see his mother again." I thought of the attack on the convoy near Kharkov. "Let's go," someone shouted, to prove he wasn't afraid. The sergeant jumped onto the first sleigh and waved us forward. We soon reached the top of the hill. The horses, panting from the climb, stopped for a moment before dashing down the other side. "Get going," shouted the sergeant. "We can't stay here. Use the whip," Hals shouted to the fellow who was driving. Our sleigh was the first to start down. I can still see our three plucky ponies jumping through the snow like rabbits, from one depression to the next, churning up a white cloud which undoubtedly was visible a long way off. The three of us huddled behind the driver, in the center of the sleigh, perched on dark green boxes which carried a disquieting inscription in white stenciled letters. We were all feeling nervous, and had forgotten the cold. I tried to watch the horizon through veils of white dust, despite our jolting progress. I thought that I could dimly see a group of ISBAs in front of us. All around us, shell holes of a remarkable symmetry mutilated the immaculate whiteness of the slope. Despite our precipitate speed, I noticed the curious borders of these excavations, which the earth thrown up by the explosions had tinged a light yellow. They looked like enormous, stylized flowers, with dark brown centers and yellow petals which turned very pale, almost white, at their outer edges. The holes which had already been there for long enough to be partly filled by new snow made a subtle variation in this curiously decorative pattern. We reached the bottom of the slope without incident. There were a few heavily damaged ISBAs, and several large guns almost buried in the snow. We stopped beside an ISBA whose roof sloped right down to the ground. The wall nearest us was of open lattice, and we could see some engineers working inside. They seemed to be taking the building apart. A few men came out carrying pieces of wood. Then a plump sergeant with a white garment pulled over his coat came up to us. "Unload right here," he said. "The engineers are preparing a shelter. It'll be finished in an hour." A loud explosion made us jump. To our right, we saw a yellow flash, and then a geyser of stones and dirt, which spouted almost 30 feet into the air. The sergeant turned calmly toward the noise. "Goddamn dirt," he said. "Harder than a rock." We concluded that these fellows were engineers playing with dynamite. The corpulent non-com looked at our orders. "Ah," he said, tapping a box of cans with a gloved finger. "These aren't for us. But our supplies are already 3 days late, and we're living on our reserves which we're not supposed to touch. If this goes on, you truck drivers certainly take your own sweet time. That's why fellows up front die of the cold. When you haven't got anything inside, you know, you can't keep going." He slapped his belly. Judging by his waistline, it was hard to imagine that he'd fasted for long. He must have had a private store of food hidden away somewhere, because it was clear that, despite our best efforts, the front lines were extremely short of supplies. "You'll have to get over that way." He pointed down the track. "That section is holding a piece of the Don Bank. And you'll go there on your hands and knees. If you know what's good for you." We set off across the snow-covered chaos, following a trail marked by trucks half buried in snow. Beyond an embankment, some big guns and heavy howitzers were hidden by a heap of piled-up snow. Once we had passed them, They simply vanished from sight, their camouflage was perfect. We came to a big trench in which a group of thin, shivering horses were pawing the hard ground. Some sacks of hay so dry it was practically dust had been ripped open and put down for them. The poor animals were sniffing at the hay with their rimy nostrils, but didn't seem too tempted. A few frozen horse cadavers lay on the ground among the animals that were still standing. A handful of soldiers in long coats were watching the horses. We passed through a string of rough dugouts, and heard machine gun fire coming from quite nearby. Machine guns. Our driver remarked, smiling strangely. That means we're here. Trenches, foxholes, and dugouts stretched away as far as we could see in all directions. We were stopped by a patrol. 9th Infantry Regiment, Company, said the lieutenant. Is it for us? No, mein Lieutenant. We're looking for their section. Ah, said the officer. You'll have to leave your sleighs here. The section you want is over there on the riverbank, and on that little island. You'll have to stick to the trenches, and be careful, because you'll be in range of the Russian forward positions, and they wake up from time to time. Thank you, mein Lieutenant. The sergeant's voice was trembling. The lieutenant called over one of the men who was with him, show them the way, and then come back. The man saluted and joined us. Like everybody else, I had grabbed a box that was too heavy for me, and was going to carry it on my back. The sound of machine gun fire began again, only louder. There it goes again. Is it serious or not? The gunfire grew louder, stopped, and began again, passionate and violent. That's us, our guide replied. But wait a few minutes. You can't tell right away whether they're doing it just for laughs, or whether it's the beginning of a push onto the ice. We listened to him without a word. He seemed almost relaxed in this disquieting atmosphere. We were perfect novices. Our few scrapes on the Third International seemed like nothing compared to what might happen here. The firing kept stopping and starting, sometimes very close. At other moments we could hear guns that were plainly further off. Howes suggested that we lay our two boxes across our Mausers, to make a kind of carrying litter. We had just reorganized ourselves to put this plan into effect when we heard some heavy detonations which followed each other in rapid succession. That's the Russians, grinned the veteran, who was walking just ahead of us. The air shook with the rhythm of the explosions. They seemed to be about 300 or 400 yards ahead of us, to our left. That's their assault artillery. It might be an attack. Suddenly, about 30 yards to the left, there was a sharp and violent burst of sound, followed by a curious, cat-like whine, followed by a series of similar sounds. We hastily put down our burdens, and ducked, looking anxiously in all directions. The air was still for a moment. Don't panic, boys, said our guide, who had also ducked. We've got a battery of 107s behind that pile of stuff over there, and we're answering the Russians. The infernal noise began again. Even though our guide had told us what it was, I could feel my stomach contracting. Put on your helmets, said the sergeant. If the Russians spot that battery, they'll fire on it. And let's keep going, our guide added. There isn't a quiet corner within 60 miles. We're no safer here than anywhere else. We began to move forward, bent double. The air around us shook for the third time, and we could hear gunfire all around us. The German battery was firing non-stop. And ahead the noise of the Spandau was getting closer. We passed 3 soldiers who were unrolling a telephone wire along a footpath which crossed our route. The sound of explosions now seemed to have a regular rhythm. This might be an attack, said the soldier who had come with us. I'll leave you here. I've got to get back to my section. Which way do we go? Asked our sergeant, who was clearly terrified. Follow the path as far as the Jess knows. Assault gun, over there on the right. They'll be able to tell you. But eat something first. It's lunchtime. He took a few steps in the other direction, doubled over, as before. So, that is how one moves on a battlefield. A few days later I was used to it, and paid no more attention. We opened our mess tins, and ate huddled in the snow. I didn't feel particularly hungry. The explosions, which made my head ring inside my icy helmet, seemed far more interesting than food.